Well, good afternoon. I want to focus today on seven traits of Jesus Christ. These traits were strengths, great strengths in him. When I was working on this, I thought to myself, well, why is this so important? And it's because they are the same traits and they're the same strengths that we eventually ought to have. Jesus Christ was humble. It was a strength in him. Is being humble that you don't speak up? No. Is being humble that you let people walk all over you? No. Is being humble that you deny yourself something physical as a means of displaying your humility? No. You know, some Catholics do that. There are different facets to the subject of humility and being humble. I just have four words that I think frames it. And it's these four words. It's not about me. Society says the opposite. Society says, it's all about me. Do you remember that Burger King slogan? Have it your way. You know, that had to do with the ability to customize your hamburger. Because it is all about you. It didn't matter really what was on the menu. If you didn't want something in your burger, you just said, look, I don't want that. Or if you wanted something else in the burger, they put it in there for you. There was a slogan that went along with that, and it was this. Hold the pickles, hold the lettuce, special orders don't upset us. All we ask is that you let us serve it your way, because it's all about me. In 2014, Burger King Corporation changed their slogan to Be Your Way. Did you know that? And this is what the corporate offices said, and this was in a press release as to why they changed their slogan, actually more so what the slogan is about. And I quote, "The new motto is intended to remind people that they can and should live how they want anytime." That's a hamburger franchise. It's not about hamburgers anymore, is it? It's about me. All about me. McDonald's has two famous slogans. We do it all for you. And you deserve a break today. Because it's all about me. Notice Matthew 21. Beginning in verse 1, we read, "Now when they drew near Jerusalem and came to Bethphage at the Mount of Olives, then Jesus sent two disciples, and he said to them," in verse 2, "Go into the village opposite you, and immediately you will find a donkey tied and a colt with her. Loose them and bring them to me. And if anyone says anything to you, you shall say, 'The Lord has need of them,' and immediately he will send them." And all this was done, in verse 4, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophet, saying, "Tell the daughter of Zion, behold your king is coming to you lowly and sitting on a donkey, a colt, the foal of a donkey." Wouldn't it be more fitting? Wouldn't it be more appropriate for Jesus Christ, the very Son of God, to be riding on a magnificent stallion instead of a donkey? Jesus said in Matthew 11, "I'm lowly in heart." What was lacking is self. His attitude, his frame of mind was not, "Look at me. Look at me. Serve me. Take care of me. Me, 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 me." It's not about me. He was humble. In Philippians 2, this is how Paul frames things. He says, beginning in verse 2, "Fulfill my joy by being like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord, of one mind." Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind. Let each esteem others better than himself. Let each of you look out not only for his own interests, but also for the interests of others. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. That was the mind, the attitude, and the approach that Jesus Christ had. Who, being in the form of God, did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation. He didn't say, look at me. Taking the form of a bondservant and coming in the likeness of men, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself. This Greek word, humbled, means to level, to reduce to a plane. It means devoid of all haughtiness. It means to bring down one's pride. And he became obedient to the point of death, even the death of the cross. The mindset of Jesus Christ was that of being humble. He said in Matthew 28 that the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. That's in Matthew 20, verse 28. He came to give. He came to serve. John 13. Beginning in verse 3 of John 13, we read, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands and that he had come from God and was going to God, rose from supper, laid aside his garments, took a towel, and girded himself. And after that, he poured water into a basin and he began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with a towel with which he was girded. Then he came to Simon Peter, and Peter said to him, Lord, are you washing my feet? And Jesus answered and said to him, what I'm doing, you don't understand now, but after this you will. And Peter said to him, you shall never wash my feet. And Jesus said to him, if I don't wash you, you have no part with me. And Simon Peter said to him, Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head. Verse 12. So when he had washed their feet and taken his garments and sat down again, he said to them, do you know what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you say, well, for so I am. But if I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. You see, it's not about me. For I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. Most assuredly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who sent greater than he who sent him. If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. The foot washing ceremony at Passover brings our attention to this point, doesn't it? About humility. It's not about me. Matthew 5. This is what Jesus Christ said. Beginning in verse 38, you heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you not to resist an evil person. Whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. But you know, a fleshly mind does not like this. Because if you slap me, I'm going to punch you. And I'm going to hit you harder than you hit me. If anyone wants to sue you, verse 40, and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. If it's about me and you want to sue me, I'm going to sue you right back. Good luck trying to get my coat or my tunic. And whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. If it's all about me, I'm not walking an extra mile. Give to him who asks you. And from him who wants to borrow from you, don't turn away. Because it's not about me. You've heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Everybody just about does that. It makes physical, carnal sense. If you hate me, I'm going to hate you back. I want nothing to do with you. But what does Christ say in verse 44? Love your enemies. Bless those who curse you. Do good to those who hate you. And pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you. And why is that? Because it's not about me. That's humility. What this wonderful passage is about is the attitude and the frame of mind that we're to have, mirroring the attitude and the frame of Jesus Christ. It's about giving. It's about serving. Because, brethren, the truth is, it's not about me. It's not about you. 1 Peter. First Peter, chapter 5. Notice the approach. Notice the attitude. 1 Peter 5, beginning in verse 5. Peter says, likewise, you younger people, submit yourselves. Submit yourselves to your elders. Yes, all of you be submissive to one another and be clothed with humility. If we're doing that, nobody's slapping anybody. Nobody is suing anyone. For God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time, casting all your care upon him, for he cares for you. Humility is a strength, and it's a strength that you and I are to have. The second strength of Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ was yielded. This was a tremendous strength, a tremendous trait in him. John 6. In verse 38, Jesus Christ says, for I have come down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me. To yield means to surrender. To yield means to submit to another. And he did it beautifully. Mark 14. Mark 14. I don't think anybody would argue that this, what we're about to read, was one of the worst evenings of Jesus Christ's life. But one of his strengths was that he was yielded. Verse 32 of Mark 14, it says that they came to a place which was named Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, sit here while I pray. And then he took Peter, James, and John with him, and he began to be troubled and deeply distressed. I don't think there are words that anybody could write about this evening that can impress on us what Jesus Christ was going through at this moment. Because he knew full well what was about to happen to him and to his body. But brethren, he was yielded. And he says in verse 34, my soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. That's the way he felt. And he said, stay here and watch. And in verse 35, it says that he went a little farther and fell on the ground because of the weight that was on his shoulders, knowing what he was about to go through. And it threw him on the ground. And then he prays that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. In verse 36, he says, Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Take this cup away from me. Because he knew what he was about to go through. But look what he says next. Nevertheless, not what I will, but what you will. He was yielded. To yield is to give something up. What did Jesus Christ give up? His back, his flesh, his body, his life, everything for our benefit. If that's not yield, then what is it? To yield also means to surrender and to give something up. And he did. He gave everything. James 3. In verse 13, we read, who is wise and understanding among you? Well, that would be a converted person. That would be a person who is humble. That would be a person who's yielded. Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth. If you're not yielded, then bitter envy and self-seeking will be your strength. This wisdom does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, and demonic. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. But the wisdom that's from above is first pure, then peaceable, then gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. When is our yield tested? When is my yield tested? When is your yield tested? You know when it's tested? When we're confronted with this choice, whether we will do or not do all that God instructs in his word. That's when our yield is tested. If you don't yield, you won't change. If you don't change, you can't grow. And if you don't grow, you will never attain to, as Paul says in Ephesians 4, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. The third strength, the third trait of Jesus Christ was that Jesus Christ was focused on his purpose. Jesus Christ was driven by purpose. Luke 4. In verse 43, this is what Jesus Christ said. I must preach the kingdom of God to the other cities also, because for this purpose I've been sent. In Mark 10, in verse 45, he says, for even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. That was his purpose. That was his focus, and that was his drive. To give of himself. To live a perfect life so he would be that perfect sacrifice. These are the questions I've been asking myself. Because we're in that season when we are examining ourselves. Are you focused or distracted? I asked myself, are you serious or just playing church? I asked myself, where are your feet? Firmly in the church? Or 1 foot in and 1 foot pointing towards the world? Brethren, it's about purpose. It's about the focus and the drive that we have for that purpose. Colossians 3. Colossians 3. In verse 3, it says, "For you died, did you? And your life is hidden with Christ in God. Is it? And when Christ, who is our life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. Therefore, put to death your members which are on the earth: fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, covetousness, which is idolatry." Don't we have great purpose in removing all of these things out of our life? Are we driven? Are we focused? The days of unleavened bread are about getting sin out of our life. Because of these things, the wrath of God is coming upon the sons of disobedience. Verse 8, "Now you yourselves are to put off all of these: anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy language out of your mouth." Just some things to think about when we think about purpose. Think about the things we need to focus on and concentrate as God's people. In 1 Corinthians 9, this is what Paul says. 1 Corinthians 9, and he begins in verse 24 by saying, "Do you not know that those who run in a race all run? Brethren, we are in a race, and we are running that race without blinders." Meaning that we can easily see all the distractions that are out there, all the detours, all the exits, all the things that take our mind and our attention off of purpose. But it's the very purpose for our calling that we are to focus on and realize that purpose moves us past all distractions. "Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize?" He says, run in such a way that you may obtain it. Forget the distractions, because they don't lead to anything. They just lead you to disengage from the race. And we cannot afford that. "Everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown." And then he tells us how he ran. He says, "I run, this is how, not with uncertainty." He had purpose. He wasn't distracted. He said, "This is how I run, not with uncertainty. That's how I fight. Not as one who beats the air. I know what I'm doing," he says. "I'm focused. I'm driven, and there is purpose in what I'm doing." And so he says in verse 27, "So I discipline my body, and I bring it into subjection. Listen, when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified." He walked the walk, in other words, just like Jesus Christ. The fourth trait, the fourth strength of Jesus Christ. Brethren, he was a fervent man. Fervent means emotionally intense, having or showing warmth, intensity of spirit, being hot, burning, glowing. Jesus Christ was not half-hearted about anything. And he did tell his disciples with fervent desire, "I have desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer." Our human tendency over time is to become complacent. Our attitude is affected by the passage of time. You know, in the beginning, things can be so exciting and so motivating. I mean, you can buy a new car and you can be washing it, cleaning it, waxing it, worried about any little drop of speck of anything to be inside the car. You'll vacuum it in the beginning, right? But after a while, after some time, it's just not so exciting anymore. And it comes to the point that when the car needs to be washed, you'll hope it just rains. Jesus Christ was fervent. He wasn't half-hearted about anything. I'll just read this in Mark. I'll be reading verse 35 of chapter 1. Now in the morning, having risen a long while before daylight, he went out and departed to a solitary place, and there he prayed. You know why Jesus Christ did this? Because he was fervent in maintaining and nurturing a very close relationship with God. He was intense. He was hot. He was burning, glowing. We're so familiar with that scripture that tells us that the love of many will wax cold in the end. It's here now. It's happening all around in society, isn't it? You can see that by the way people treat each other, the things that they do to one another. But what about the church? Unfortunately, there's a whole era that is described as complacent, compromising, and lethargic. And that's the Laodicean era. With that Laodicean attitude, I want nothing to do with that attitude or era. Nothing. We must be fervent. Romans 12. Look at the way Paul frames this and what he says, beginning in verse 9 of Romans 12. Let love be without hypocrisy. Abhor what is evil, cling to what's good. Be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love, in honor, giving preference to one another. Not lagging in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving God, rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, continuing steadfastly in prayer, distributing to the needs of the saints, given to hospitality. That's a lot, isn't it? But for an individual that's yielded and humble, has purpose, it means everything, doesn't it? Bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. Be of the same mind towards one another. Do not set your mind on high things. Associate with the humble. And don't be wise in your own opinion. It's about what we do. It's about what we value. It's about what we seek. It's spiritual things. And the question is, are we fervent about it? Again, Paul in Romans 13. He says in verse 12, the night is far spent, the day is at hand. Therefore, let us cast off the works of darkness and let us put on the armor of light. Let us walk properly as in the day, not in revelry and drunkenness, not in lewdness and lust, not in strife and envy. Society's so good at that. But put on the Lord Jesus Christ. You know that Jesus Christ had wonderful traits, wonderful strengths. And it says here, put that on and make no provisions for the flesh to fulfill its lusts. The fifth strength of Jesus Christ, the fifth trait. You know, Jesus had much compassion. Matthew 14. Matthew 14 and verse 14, it says, and when Jesus went out, he saw a great multitude, and he was moved with compassion for them and healed their sick. This word in Greek, turned into a phrase here, moved with compassion, means to have the bowels yearn. In other words, it came from within. This was not a put-on. It was deep, moving, and real. The Greek word literally means to be moved in the inward parts, to feel compassion, sympathy, and pity. The dictionary defines compassion as a feeling of sympathy for the suffering of others, aroused with the desire to help them. Matthew 15. In verse 30, we read, "Then great multitudes came to him, having with them the lame, blind, mute, maimed, and many others, and they laid them down at Jesus' feet, and he healed them. So the multitudes marveled when they saw the mute speak, the maimed made whole, the lame walking, the blind seeing, and they glorified the God of Israel. Now Jesus called his disciples to himself, and he said, 'I have compassion on the multitudes.'" I mean, he's still moved. Something that came from within, a feeling of sympathy for the suffering of others, aroused with a desire to help them. He already healed them all. And he still wants to do more for them. He wants to feed them now. Incredible amount of compassion for people he didn't even know. But he gave. And he gave because he was compassionate. Matthew 18. There's a story here. It's a story of the forgiven debt. And I think what oozes in this story is compassion. Matthew 18, beginning in verse 23. "Therefore the kingdom of heaven," Jesus says, "is like a certain king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. And when he had begun to settle accounts, one was brought to him who owed him 10,000 talents." That's a lot. You're in debt. That's a heavy burden. "But he was not able to pay." That's a horrible feeling. You got to pay up now. All that you owe me. Today's the day of reckoning. You have to pay. "His master commanded that he be sold with his wife and children and all that he had, and that payment may be made." In other words, you would have nothing at the end of the day. Not even the right to your own life, because you're being sold as a slave. "The servant therefore fell down before him, saying, 'Master, have patience with me, and I will pay you all.'" Can you imagine the desperation in that man's mind? "I'll do anything. Don't sell me and my family. Don't take everything away from me. I'll pay you." And the master of that servant was moved with compassion. It's the same Greek word that we saw in Matthew 14:14. And in Matthew chapter 15, it literally means to be moved in the inward parts, to feel compassion, sympathy, pity. It means a feeling of sympathy for the suffering of others, aroused with a desire to help them. He was moved with compassion and released him and forgave him the debt. Everything is off the books now. You owe me nothing. That great debt, you're free. You and your family, I'll take nothing that's yours. You can go. "But that servant went out and found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 denarii, very little. And he laid hands on him and took him by the throat. And he said, 'Pay me what you owe.' So his fellow servant fell down at his feet and begged him, saying, 'Have patience with me and I will pay you all.' And he would not, but threw him into prison." What's this story about? Isn't it about one who had compassion? And through that compassion, how a whole family benefited. But the man that was forgiven of his debt learned nothing, because he did not have 1 ounce of compassion in himself. And he caused havoc on the life of another person. For very little, he had to go to prison. For very little, he had his neck strangled. 1 John. First John 4. In verse 7, it says, "Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God, and everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. And he who does not love does not know God, for God is love. Love for one another. Compassion for one another. Isn't this the love that John is talking about? That which comes from within, that's deep, moving, and real. It's about giving, and it's about being selfless. It's about living your life the way Jesus Christ did. It's about looking at the traits and the strengths that our Savior had and desiring those traits and those strengths to be in ourselves. Matthew 20. In verse 25, Jesus called them to himself and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you. Whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant. And whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave." In verse 28, he says, "Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many." This was the mind, this was the character, this was the trait and the strength of Jesus Christ. Is it ours? In the circle of your life. What is in the circle of your life and my life? Well, marriage, family, relatives. And what about each other in the church of God? Are we compassionate? Jesus Christ was. Trait number 6. Jesus Christ was patient. Society is all about the now. So am I. I mean, would anybody here go back to dial-up internet? It's just too slow. I don't have the patience to wait for that. What about opening night at the movies? You know, when there's a blockbuster coming out? It just seems that everybody wants to go out and watch the movie, right? On opening weekend, and it's so crowded, you can't find parking, you can't find a good seat. Because I've done that. Why? Because I can't wait a couple of weeks. If you just wait 2 weeks, the theater is basically empty for that movie because everybody's already seen it. We're not very patient, are we? It's not a strength in me. I noticed it yesterday when I was in the bank. I'm standing in line, and the tellers, they were so slow. Come to find out that the tellers they had were brand spanking new. They were in training still. Now, why would you do that on a Friday, which generally you have a lot of people show up? So I'm in line fuming, thinking to myself, well, saying things to myself, that if I would have said them out loud, it would have insulted everyone. Because patience is not a strength in me. But it was a strength in Jesus Christ. Mark 3. Mark 3. Let's start in verse 7 of Mark 3. Jesus withdrew with his disciples to the sea, and a great multitude from Galilee followed him, and from Judea and Jerusalem and Idumea and beyond the Jordan, those from Tyre and Sidon, a great multitude. And when they heard how many things he was doing, came to him. So he told his disciples that a small boat should be kept ready for him because of the multitude, lest they should crush him. I mean, there are so many people around them, all pushing. Why? Because in verse 10 it says, "For he healed many, so that as many as had afflictions pressed about him to touch him." Surrounded. All these people from all these cities, I mean, crushed with people, all trying to touch him. That's a lot to take. Didn't he have to go to the bathroom? Wasn't he hungry that he had to go eat something? couldn't do either one because of the crush of people that was around him, all trying to touch him. I mean, you would think at a certain point he would say, "That's enough, stop touching me." But he didn't. He never lost his composure with those that he served because he was patient. If you turn to Matthew 4, this is a pivotal event in the life of Jesus Christ. But I want to take this as we read it today, considering the test of patience that occurred here in Matthew 4. Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And when he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, afterwards he was hungry. Now when the tempter came to him, he said, "If you are the Son of God, command that these stones become bread." What is Satan saying? Turn these stones to bread now. You're starving. You're hungry. You haven't eaten for 40 days. You need to eat now. Patience is composure when in difficult straits. But he answered and said, "It is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God." Jesus Christ was patient. He wasn't rattled by these difficult straits. Then the devil took him up into the holy city, set him on the pinnacle of the temple, and said to him, "If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down. For it is written, he shall give his angels charge over you, and in their hands they shall bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone." What's Satan saying here? You're the Son of God? Prove it. Prove it now. Because as the way I see it, you're all alone. Who's your father? You are all alone in the wilderness. You have no food. You haven't eaten. Nothing's been provided for you. Who are you? Prove it. Prove it now. Patience is a constant, not a variable. There's a steadiness in patience, isn't there? Jesus Christ didn't crack. He said, "It is written, you shall not tempt the Lord your God." Again, the devil took him up on an exceedingly high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to him, "All these things I will give you if you will fall down and worship me." And in Luke's account, and I'll just read that to you, Luke 4, verse 6. "And the devil said to him, 'All this authority I will give you and their glory, for this has been delivered to me, and I give it to whomever I wish.'" What's Satan saying? You can be in charge now. You can fix all the things that's wrong in the world now. All the injustice, all the wrong, all the hurt, all that you see, you can fix it now. You know what patience is? Staying on course. In due time, Jesus Christ will return as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. This was not the time. I read a story that really is a story about patience. I saw many different versions of the story. Essentially, the story is the same. What's different are just little different details about this farmer. He was a Chinese farmer and he had quite a few acres of land. And he wanted to plant a crop that would yield for him and his family a measure of wealth and security, because growing vegetables was just not enough. So he studied thoroughly a crop that would provide that. And he found a certain type of bamboo. It's called Chinese bamboo. It's extremely fast growing. There was a strong demand for it. And there was relatively few among growers who produced it. He went ahead and he purchased hundreds of seeds. He carefully prepped his land, and you know that he planted each seed by himself over several acres. He nurtured the seedlings, and every day he watered every single seedling with a bucket. He was very careful about fertilizing. He was worried about the weeds, and he put a lot of time and energy into all those bamboo seeds. After 1 year, nothing sprouted. After 2 years of doing the same thing every day, nothing sprouted. In the third year, his patience was tested. He began to wonder if all his efforts and the care would ever materialize in anything. And it bothered him. But he kept caring. After 3 full years, not one seedling, not one, broke the ground. In the fourth year, he started to doubt his investment. He got angry. He got angry at the company that sold him the seeds because maybe they were rotten, maybe they weren't any good. He was angry at the birds because they probably ate them and the insects. But he decided to keep watering and fertilizing his land. After 4 full years, nothing. But in the fifth year, something amazing happened. He noticed little bamboo shoots. Not spotty in places, the entirety of his property that he had planted. And he literally saw the shoots growing right before his eyes. And do you know that in just 6 weeks, those Chinese bamboo trees, what they call them, they were 80 feet tall. There are over 10,000 species of bamboo. And it is this type of bamboo that its growth rate is phenomenal. This particular type of bamboo has been observed to grow as much as 3 feet in one 24-hour period. Now, does a bamboo tree, or this particular bamboo tree, lie dormant for 4 years, and in the fifth year have all that growth explosion? No. It grows underground for 4 years. To develop a root system strong enough to support the outward growth in its fifth year and beyond. You see, those trees needed to build a foundation first, and that's the same thing about patience. Patience is the root system of our character. Our patience is often tested, isn't it? Will our efforts, our caring, our waiting ever be rewarded? It's easy to begin to doubt. Patience is what you and I exercise while we wait. This is what James says. James 5, beginning in verse 7, James says, "Therefore, be patient, brethren, until the coming of the eternal. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, waiting patiently for it until it receives the early and the later rain. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the eternal is at hand. The things we want at times seem slower to come than we want. But we have to patiently toil towards those worthwhile goals that we have. There's a calling that we are constantly answering for. Romans 2:7. Romans 2:7. Eternal life to those who by patient continuance in doing good. Seek for glory, honor, and immortality. It's not all about the now. It's about what we are doing in preparation for our future. And patience is so important. The last one, the seventh point. Jesus Christ had faith. It was a strength, a great strength in him. Notice this account in Mark 9. In verse 17, we read, "Then one of the crowd answered and said, 'Teacher, I brought you my son who has a mute spirit. And wherever it seizes him, it throws him down. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. So I spoke to your disciples that they should cast it out, but they could not.'" And look what Jesus Christ says. "He answered him and said, 'O faithless generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I bear with you? Bring him to me.'" You know what's missing here? Doubt. There was no doubt in Jesus Christ. Doubt is uncertainty. Doubt is fear. Doubt is a lack of certainty. Matthew 8, verse 23. "Now when he got into a boat, his disciples followed him, and suddenly a great tempest arose on the sea, so that the boat was covered with the waves, but he was asleep. Then his disciples came to him and awoke him, saying, 'Lord, save us, we're perishing.'" I've never been in a situation like that. But I can imagine that these disciples, many of them, they made a living from fishing. And if conditions are that bad that they think they're going to die, that's pretty bad. But he said to them, notice what he says, "Why are you fearful, O you of little faith?" Why are you so uncertain? Why are you doubting? Why are you fearful? It's a matter of faith, isn't it? Perhaps, I mean, one way of looking at it, maybe they should have been able to handle it themselves if they had enough faith. Because Jesus Christ arose and rebuked the wind and the sea, and there was great calm. Do you think they should have done that if they had the faith? Or at least been able to? Matthew 14. Let's start in verse 22. "Immediately Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he sent the multitudes away. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. Now when evening came, he was alone there. But the boat was now in the middle of the sea, tossed by the waves, for the wind was contrary. Now in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went to them walking on the sea. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, 'It's a ghost.' And they cried out for fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, 'Be of good cheer. It is I. Do not be afraid.' And Peter answered him and said, 'Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water.' And so he said, 'Come.' And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But verse 30, when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, 'Lord, save me.' And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand, caught him, and said to him, 'O you of little faith, why did you doubt?'" Well, I think I've got three good reasons. Number one, look at the wind. And since he's out on the water, there is nothing for him to grab onto. And what about the waves? the fact that it's dark. It's probably cold. I would think that he's thinking, I think I'm going to drown. And the third reason is human beings don't walk on water. But Christ said to him, O you of little faith, why did you doubt? I'm here, and I told you to come out here. God's in your life. Why do we doubt? Because life at times is just too windy. And you feel, and I feel, like we just have nothing to grab onto. Why do we doubt? Because often the waves in life are just too rough. And we convince ourselves that we're going to drown. It's easy to become discouraged. It's easy to doubt. The truth is, God's in your life. Mark 11. Verse 22. Jesus answered and said to them, have faith in God. For assuredly I say to you, whoever says to this mountain, be removed and be cast into the sea, and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that those things he says will be done, he will have whatever he says. Is this just something that was written in by a scribe later, just to be a little encouraging? This is from the mouth of Jesus Christ. He says he will have whatever he says. Therefore, I say to you, whatever thing you ask when you pray, believe that you receive them and you will have them. There are different facets to the subject of faith. I'm just focusing on the trust and the hope that we are to have in God. Remember what Jesus said? Father, I thank you that you have heard me, and I know that you always hear me. Now, is that only for Jesus Christ? Only for him, because of who he was? This is what we read in 1 Peter. 1 Peter 3 and verse 12. For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are open to their prayers. Both ears. I can't erase that. If we were able to throw away every Bible that's ever been printed, this promise still stands. You can't get rid of it. 1 John chapter 5, beginning in verse 14. Now this is the confidence that we have in him. Confidence is trust. Confidence is hope. Confidence is the faith that we have in God. And that what he says in his word, he will do. Because it says, this is the confidence that we have in him, that if we ask anything according to his will, he hears us. And if we know that he hears us, whatever we ask, we know that we have the petitions that we have asked of him. Says anything. Either God's for real or he's not. He's real. He hears. That's a fact. That's a promise. These seven traits and seven strengths of Jesus Christ are so important. He was humble. He was yielded. He had purpose. He was fervent, compassionate, patient, and full of faith. Passover is coming. The days of unleavened bread are coming. We're supposed to be examining ourselves. What's the standard? What are we looking to? Jesus Christ. These traits and these strengths need to be found in us.